Greetings and welcome to Baron Crazes Visions of Horror episode number 25, covering the week of June 18th through June 24th. While the show may be airing a little bit behind schedule, all right, about a month behind schedule, there's a lot of things that are going on behind the scenes, and therefore I can't get into some of them because I'm just not allowed. Anyway, we started off the show with the band Ground Meat with the track Pathological Silence. They are found on Facebook, and they are found on Bandcamp. Of course, right after that, you also did get to hear another track. It was the band Unwoman with the track Season of the Witch. This artist's music is found on Bandcamp. All right, so here we are, June 18th, Sunday, with the movie. Well, it's pretty obvious. It's Season of the Witch from 1972. Also on this day, I did see the film called Body Snatchers from 1993. That Body Snatchers film would be considered the, I think, the third version of the invasion of the Body Snatchers. If I'm not mistaken, there were about four different variations on that film. The first one being very good. The second one in 78 was also equally good with a couple freakout scenes there. And this one here is also a real good stellar one, too. The one with Nicole Kidman sucks. All right, so anyway, Season of the Witch was rated R, 2 hours and 10 minutes long. It's celebrating no anniversary. The reason for watching it, for basically, how did I pick this one instead of, say, Body Snatchers? I think really it just came down to, there's a song, I think it's by an artist named Devin, keeps coming on so often, and just, I guess maybe drowned in my brain somehow, that I said, I am just going to watch this movie. And that kind of got a lot of other people to watch the film with me, and that's just how it happened. So the film is from the genre horror element. It's from director George A. Romero, who also was the writer. And we'll get into the some of the stars in just a moment. It came out from a company called Jack H. Period Harris Enterprises. Now, the stars, Jan White, Raymond Lane, and Muffy Lee, Jodada McLean, who else here? Bill Thunhurst and Neil Fisher, excuse me. So what's the summary for this film? Well, neglected, unhappy, housewife in suburbia gets mixed up in witchcraft with unexpected consequences. All right, it got a 5.6 out of 10, and the release date originally for this film was December 27th of 1972. Now, the tagline for the film, and there's about four of them. One of these I would definitely say is a little too long, but we'll get into everything. Caviar in the kitchen, nothing in the bedroom. Uh-huh. All right, how about this one? Hungry wives with an appetite for diversion. All right. First, Night of the Living Dead, then Dawn of the Dead, and now George A. Romero brings you Season of the Witch. And lastly is Every Night is Halloween. Let me tell you something right now. None of those do any justice to the movie. None of them. The third one is trying to appeal to your sense of, well, I like Night of the Living Dead, and I like The Dawn of the Dead, and now George is back with another movie, so I'm going to like this too. No. This is weak. It's lazy. I never liked that for a tagline, being a tagline doctor. I never do that. I never, ever, ever reach out and try to use certain star names into the taglines. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes to a contract where I'm asked to do taglines, I'm asked to put those people's names into one. I'll do it because that's what the contract states. That's what somebody wants me to do. I will do it, of course. But I don't push it as a tagline because I don't find it to be worthy. It doesn't convey the film. Your log line, your summary, your film itself should generate enough to me to come up with some sort of tagline to make you want to go and see the film. Caviar in the kitchen, nothing in the bedroom. Yeah, that doesn't work really well because, again, how many people have had caviar? Not many. It doesn't really give you that appeal. They got the hungry whys with the appetite for diversion. Again, it's missing the implications here. And the last one, every night is Halloween. Think about this. The movie comes out in December, right? And you're telling me Halloween. Well, wouldn't that have been back in October? So this is really like misdirected there. Maybe something along the lines of, I don't know, so here, unwrapping this gift is dangerous. There you go, right? So that's five words there. Unwrapping is one, right? This gift is dangerous. There you go. That's what I would have done. So that would have told you something. It's a gift. Okay, a gift. That can make you think of different things there, right? Think about a gift. So a gift of witchcraft, a gift of some sort of existential, ability. Here's this gift I'm giving, right? And now if you unwrap this gift, it's dangerous. In this way, it could be dangerous, deviant. Any one of these words would work in here. And diabolical. You could really get fun with this. And therefore, that would be more interesting because you would get it. Oh, there's a gift. It's unwrapped. And it does this, whatever it is. And therefore, you fill in the blank. And there you go. You're giving the people everything they want. They've got the MacGuffin, which is the gift. It's being unwrapped as the action. And what it does is further describing that happens in the film. So right there you go. And you're going, wow, Baron, that was great. And let me tell you how long it took me to come up with that. I sat right here, right now, and I came up with it. So it took me approximately 5 seconds. 5 seconds, and I just gave you a new tagline for the film. You think somebody's going to use it? No. But here's one. In our tagline directory that we have here at the Baron Crazes Little Guru of Horror House, we got the tagline directory. In there, we're going to be putting down the one I just gave you and put it in a different color and put it for that film. That's right. There's ours. Okay, moving right along. Some references here. It references Rosemary's Baby from 1968, and it referenced in Hack-O-Lantern from 1988. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, a couple of you who probably don't know what Hack-O-Lantern is are probably like, what the hell is that? You're not missing a lot. Not lying to you. Not missing a lot there. Maybe we'll cover it in October. I don't know what the films are that have been selected. And that should be another thing I should mention real quick here. The films that I go over here on Visions of Horror, again, is an extension of our column. And what happens is I don't select these movies. Friends, fiends, some foes probably also select the films. They put them on the list. And lately, they've been getting into a theme of trying to get me anniversary films. And occasionally, one like this pops through. That's not an anniversary movie. So my opinion of this is a highly, highly underrated movie. All right? It is probably a very obsolete film. Would go as far as a liberated horror movie into the true women's aspect, a very kind of feminist horror film, if you would, of the 70s, very early 70s. It kind of reminds me a little of Burn Witch Burn. So if you're familiar with that film, you'll definitely understand this. The witchcraft does play a part, and let's be honest there. But it really focuses on the leading lady, the feeling of the solitary confinement, the kind of sterile life she's having, the absent husband that's abusive in his tone and nature. The daughter is get away, mom, kind of attitude, leave me alone. I'm in my world now. I'm leaving yours behind. Kind of the disingenuine, gossipy friends, you've seen the movies where these tropes are. Where you have a group of friends, and they're supposed to be your friends, but reality is they do nothing but backstab each other. I mean, if it came down to them each deciding who had to die to live, they'd just be cutting each other apart faster than anything else. And I have to be honest, not everything in the film works. It's got some editing issues, almost if they didn't know exactly how to steer this film, and it came out with something, but it just doesn't feel like a smooth ride. I mean, if I really had to give you a kind of description that you really get behind, and it's being a summertime, I think this will work. Ever been on one of those kind of log flume rides, and you're in the log flume, and it's got a track, let's be honest, it's got a track under it, but the log thing is kind of bouncing off the walls and splashing. That's like this. It's not exactly straight, right on the edge like a roller coaster is. You know, that's just there. You know, here it's bumping and banging. It's getting to the finish line, but, oh, it's just a little, sore and everything else. So that, I guess that's a great way to describe this film. Some consider this a lost film. I don't. It has been put out nicely, Blu-ray now. But, of course, in 2006, Anchor Bay Entertainment, they did release a very nice version of this film. So if you can't find it, I would encourage you to watch it that way. I would also say, definitely, as you notice, I say drama horror movie. I put the drama comes first, then the horror, which really makes you wonder about this movie. It's more of a kind of a deep thinking movie. It's really going to get into the mindset there. And it's not really going to appeal to everybody. It's not. If you're not into giving women equal treatment in horror movies and such, then you're not probably going to like this movie. Okay? You have to be open to exploring a new element. And I just don't know if some people will have that kind of connotation for that particular movie. The film is found on Tubi and Blu-ray. And we're going to be closing it out here with the band Hideous Monster. And the track is Season of the Witch. right, so you guys got to hear Hideous Monster, which is the band's name, and the track was Season of the Witch. Actually, that track is really an ode to the Halloween 3, but, you know, for this, I decided to throw it in there for Season of the Witch for this movie. All right, so the band is found on Facebook, Bandcamp, and Instagram, and I even put up a video for them, which, of course, is more akin to Halloween 3 than the actual one for the for that particular movie. But, you know, I liked the song. I liked the band. I thought it was really great, and we're going to have them on an upcoming episode of Screaming Horror, which is our horror punk kind of show, which has got, I think now, over 200, seriously, over 200 horror punk bands. I mean, it's unbelievable the number of bands have been contacting us that are horror punk. So that show has really transformed itself, and we got a show coming up in, I think, in about a week's time, and you guys are going to love it again. It's 3 hours long, by the way. All right, so anyway, welcome to June 19th, which is the Monday. With the film Office Uprising from 2018, this was a TV-MA, 1 hour and 32 minutes long, celebrating a fifth anniversary. It's an action comedy horror movie. Now, as for the director and the cast, there is no way, no way I can figure out how to say the director's name. I've been thinking about it, and I can't do it. So I'm going to use the Google Translator for a little bit of help on this one. So hopefully this works out correctly.
Lynn Oding.
Okay, that worked out a little well. Let me pump up that sound a little bit. We're going to try it one more time because I don't think that came across really well. So let's try it one more time.
Lynn Oding.
Thank you very much, Google Translator. So Lynn was the director. The writers were Ian Shore and Peter Gamble. And as for the stars for the film, there's a few of them, and let's get a little help from the Google Translator again. Here we go.
Brenton Thwaites, Jane Levy, Karen Soney, Zachary Levi, Greg Henry, Kurt Fuller, Ian Harding, Barry Shabaka Henley, Alan Richson.
Yeah, I would never have gotten Barry's last name. There's no question about that. And Brenton, I probably had some serious trouble with that name too. So with that being said, we got a little help from the Google Translator. The company put out the film was known as Mega Films Distribution. Its summary is an employee at a weapons factory discovers that an energy drink turns his co-workers into zombies. Well, not quite, but we'll get into that. It got a 5.7 out of 10, and a release date for it was originally June 19th of 2018. So you'll get to watch that film on its anniversary. Taglines. There's only one. This is exactly how it reads. Worst, period, day, work day ever. So it was worst work day ever, separated by periods. And saying that sounds really tiring and not good. So, you know, there you go. You know, it basically saying, you know, more or less, after today, promotions suck, you know, or... You know, not the company to work for. I mean, there you go, right? Not the company to work for. So five words again. It tells you, you don't want to work for this company. This is not the company you want to. This is not going to be good. Now, the budget for this was $2.5 million. Really not much information to go on about the film. So let's just dive right into opinions. Office Uprising is probably one of those latest films to be the Office horror theme movie. That's pretty much what it is. Another film that kind of goes in this vein that I kind of liked a little bit more than this movie was Mayhem from 2017 that deals pretty much with the virus and people going apeshit crazy, okay? Now, this movie is hyper-violent, yes. Frantic, yeah. Some substance, you know, starts wavering there. It's got some comedic moments, of course, but there's some elements I just didn't find to be totally to my liking. So it's a film you're gonna either like or you're going to hate. You could be in the middle of the road. It's really just up and down. Biggest thing I want to say, it's not a zombie movie. Okay? What happens here is that the workers basically are taking an energy drink, And this energy drink basically does something weird to their bodies and makes them go into psychotic rages. And, okay, so they go into psychotic rages. They're totally apeshit crazy. They're ripping people's heads off. They're doing all these things, yes. But does that make them zombies? And I'm not really sold on the fact that they're zombies. Because it's just, I don't know, I don't find it to be a zombie movie. And I could be wrong on that one, but I just don't find it. It's got an awful lot of silliness and craziness, and there's some heavy level of stupidity running amok in the film. But it's just something where I found it not to be zombies, but rather a virus-like chemical kind of reaction. So this would be maybe on the lines of again, like a 28 Days Later. You wouldn't say really, because it gets kind of confusing in 28 Days Later, whether they are built on the rage virus and they're just gone apeshit crazy, full adrenaline rush, or do they turn zombies? Because near the end of that movie, yeah, the dead, or not really the dead, they're not actually dead, they're more, again, infected, begin to exhibit some bit of zombie-like behaviorisms. You know, ripping apart a guy's body, feeding on it, that's more into the zombie. So it's almost like they're blurring the line heavily. And here they're doing that too. There's a lot of blurring on that. So it depends on what mood you're in. If you're looking for that Office Mayhem kind of movie, then this would be up your, right up there. If you're looking for straight up zombie, this may not be what you want. So be aware of that. All right. And basically we've got a slacker who is truly slacking off in a lot of the movie. This film is found on Crackle and Tubi. And with that being said, we're going to move right out of this one into our Tuesday one. But we're going to first play a band called The Guilt with the track At the Office. And you can find The Guilt on Bandcamp. By the way, to find them on Bandcamp, you're going to go with Guilt, then S-W-E, and then the Bandcamp. So that's a good way of finding them. So enjoy this track. right, so we didn't have any film watching on June 20th, the Tuesday, but we did have something that I saw there on the 21st, Wednesday. It was called Cheerleader Camp from 1988. Now, this is rated R. It's 1 hour and 29 minutes long, and it's a film that's definitely geared to the male teenage market. No question about it. None. Now, there have been a few horror films that deal solely with cheerleaders, all cheerleaders must die, these kind of films like this, cheerleader massacre movies. There's been a few of them out there. Not a lot. Usually they just kind of become one of those stereotypical characters in the movies and get slaughtered. But anyway, so what we have here is a film celebrating a 35th anniversary. It's a comedy horror thriller. The director was John Quinn. The writers were David Lee, not sure how to say this last name. It's F-E-I-N. I didn't know how to say it about, 5 minutes ago. Someone told me, and boom, out of my brain. And also, R. O'Keefe. Now, as for the people who starred in the movie, we're going to get a little help from the Google Translator, because it's a list, and I'm not going to get all the names right. And why butcher all these names? So, I will tell you of one name on the list. George Buckflower had done a lot of secondary roles in a lot of films. Great type of character actor to do a lot of little things. So definitely got to just single him out right away. But hey, here's the list.
Betsy Russell, Leif Garrett, Lucinda Dickey, Laurie Griffin, George Buckflower, Travis McKenna, Terry Weigel, Craig Polijan, Rebecca Ferrati.
All right, so there you guys go for that. As for the companies that put it out, I'm actually going to give you two here. First up is Prism Entertainment. I know, that is really going back there. That's from 1988 and was on a VHS. Then Anchor Bay Entertainment in 2004 released a DVD of this film. In summary, a group of cheerleaders become the targets of an unknown killer at a remote summer camp. So, you already can tell where we're going with this, right? Got a 4.6 out of 10. The release date for it was June 21st of 1988. Now, we've got three taglines. So, here we go. I'm going to try to give my best on one of these here. So, if I don't, forgive me. Give me a K. Give me an I. Give me an L. Give me an L. There's your tagline. Got it? Good. Competition was murder at cheerleader camp. Some girls would kill to be cheerleaders. If it's a cheerleader camp, that means they're already cheerleaders. Therefore, how are some girls going to be killed for being cheerleaders? They're already cheerleaders. I have a problem with that one. The competition was murder at cheerleader camp. Okay, I can kind of go with that one. It does fit the standard there. Because we can say, well, at is the little word, and we can get it in there with six. The first one just doesn't work. It's too long. I understand where we're going with it. Perhaps it would work if you are going to trail those taglines down the page. But I've seen the poster, and that's not how they're trailed down the page. They're kind of just stacked underneath each other. If they were, I don't know, maybe you had multiple cheerleaders on the poster art with the high kick, and the words written on their legs in blood or something, maybe that would have gotten you, because, you know, look, it's 1988, you could have gotten away with it on the movie poster for this, but it's not that way. So with that being said, the film's original title was called Bloody Pom Poms, and this title was actually still used in various countries, such as Germany. I kind of like the title Bloody Pom Poms. It would have obviously played onto the female anatomy, yes, but I think it would have worked really well, especially because there's a scene that uses the pom-poms. It really does. So I think that would have been a pretty cool name. Many of the actors in the film were actual cheerleaders from a local high school of Bakersfield. Bakersfield, a name that's been used in a lot of horror movies over the years, so it's always neat to see that back there. It references A Nightmare on Elm Street from 1984, and it was spoofed in Scary Movie from 2000. Now, it was referenced in the following films: Scream 2 from 1997, The American Nightmare from 2000, Cheerleader Massacre from 2003, Going to Pieces, The Rise and Fall of the Slasher Film from 2006, and Horror Business from 2007. And most recently, it did get followed up with a sequel called Cheerleader Camp to the Death from 2023. Now, for my opinions. Okay, look. It's a slasher flick. No question about it. It's got a lot of the black humor thrown into it. And some fairly okay, decent death gory scenes. The plot, come on, you all know what it is, right? You don't have to really guess too long at it. And you don't need to guess at who the killer is. That's pretty easily telegraphed, foreshadowed, and just communicated really easily. And of course, you know, you have your unseen maniac doing all the killing. We know that, right? Prowling around, killing the cheerleaders. So that's pretty common standard fare there. And I guess you're trying to say it is a horror film. But obviously, the filmmakers were preoccupied with lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of nudity. Sex-related jokes. The horror is thrown in there, but it's almost like an afterthought, a lot of the film through there. It has one really good gore scene, like I said. But look, again, it's geared for the teenage male market. That's what it's geared for. That doesn't say, you know, a female horror fan out there that likes the gore too isn't going to like it. No, she probably will. But, this is not a film for a lot of reasons. This is not going to be, hey, maybe you're a woman who always hated the cheerleaders in your high school, so maybe you could work through a therapeutic moment through the film, but it's not really going to have that kind of revenge aspect that you're looking for. If you're looking for that, I would really advise you to go make your own movie and make it work that way. I think that will work well. It's just that. Now, for me, I watched this movie on basically a bootleg, if you would. I'm being honest about it. I'm not lying. Copy of the movie, so that's how we watched it. I actually saw it at a friend's house, so he has quite a few extensive films from different places he got them at. And we just watched a bootleg of the movie. So with that being said, I'm going to kind of close out this one with a band called White Cowbell Oklahoma with the track Cheerleader. Hey! All right, so you all just got to listen to the band White Cowbell Oklahoma, and the track was Cheerleader. Shocking enough, there's no information on the band, but the fans are going to go out to the Asher Media Relations company found on Facebook, and also through, they got their own .com page, and I believe there's a Bandcamp page for them too, and probably some other social media out there. So if you can, check them out, support them, and there we go. All right, so there was no film on Thursday, June 22nd, so it moves us right to June 23rd, Friday. And the film from 1978 was Manitou. This is rated PG, 1 hour and 44 minutes long, celebrating a 45th anniversary. The genre for the film was horror slash sci-fi. The director was William Guyer. I know I just screwed that up, sorry. G-I-R-D-L-E-R. He was also one of the writers on the film, along with John Cedar, Thomas Pope, and Graham Masterton, who actually wrote the novel. Now, as for the stars of the film, you know, I know I will butcher this grandly, just like I just butchered the director's name, so sorry. So I'm going to ask the Google Translator really for a little help on these names so I don't butcher it any further. So let's get over there.
Tony Curtis, Michael Ansara, Susan Strasberg, Stella Stevens, John Cedar, Ann Southern, Burgess Meredith, Paul Manti, Jeanette Nolan, Lorene Tuttle.
All right. See, I would have screwed up at least three of those names, and I just don't feel like doing it anymore, at least right now. Don't worry. I will butcher something very soon. It is my trademark to do that. Anyway, the comment put out the film was AVCO Embassy Pictures. The summary, well, a psychic's girlfriend finds out that a lump on her back is growing a reincarnation. Right there, I know you're saying, wait a minute, what? Right. Of a 400-year-old demonic Native American spirit. Okay. Yeah, I know. Kind of weird, right? Now, amazingly, this film does get a 5.3 out of 10. It was originally released on April 28th of 1978. Now, and there are a few, about four taglines. Two of them are excessively long. One was obviously deployed later on for something, but there's no stipulation of why it was deployed. So, yeah, I guess we should get into it, right? Because this is how messed up this is. Now, remember, this is 1978. Here we go. Time cannot stop him. Space cannot hold him. Science cannot destroy him. The Manitou, it has awakened. All right. Now the second one. Evil does not die. It waits to be reborn. All righty. The third one. Oh, dear Lord, here we go. Possession marked the exorcist. Demonic pregnancy erupted Rosemary's baby. Warnings follow the omen. The Manitou has it all combined. Okay. Mm-hmm. See where we're going here? And lastly, in the grisly tradition of Alien. All right. Let's talk about these taglines, because I always find these things always be interesting. I know that we've already gone over the lessons of how many words they should be, what they should do. Let's get into this again. So, the first one is just too damn long. It just is. If you really think about it, it's approximately 20 words long. Too long. Nobody's going to read that. It's too much. The third one is trying to give you a lot of suggestions. It's trying to give you the thought of the exorcist. Okay, that's 73. Rosemary's Baby, that's 68. The Omen, okay, that's 76. So it's trying to give you all these great kind of demonic films, right? Which was known as the Unholy Three because of their close proximity of release. So if you think about that, that's what it's trying to do. It's trying to throw those suggestions out to you of why you should watch this movie. The last one is says in the grisly tradition of Alien. Well, wait a minute. The film came out in 78. Alien comes out in 79. So there is no reference point to when this particular tagline comes up. obviously it must come up after 79. So was it used for a VHS tape? Was it used for a DVD? We don't know because there's no, no identification for it. So it's a kind of weird thing. Now, the final one, really, which was the number two tagline, I guess works. It's not well done, but evil does not die. It waits to be reborn. I mean, you're telling us what we're supposed to know. So evil, you know, reborn. Okay, can't you just say that? Evil, you know, the rebirth or something like that. The rebirth of evil. Anything like this, you know, something like that, you know. Evil creeping up on you. Something like this, okay? So we get a thing. These kind of aspects. You know, you could even put down evil has hatched. The eruption of evil. Something like this. This would have worked. You had the word evil. You had a word birthing, reborn, and that. All those would have worked. Everything else is just so convoluted for it. I just don't like it. Your tagline should be something that reaches out and grabs hold of the audience. That's what it does. And by not doing that, I just get lost at that. So the budget for the film was $3 million. Now, some trivia on the film. When this film premiered in South Africa in 1978, the invitations were actually printed on vomit bags. I never really thought of this film as one of those vomit-inducing movies. So I think this was just their form of trying to entice people to watch the film. And this was something they came up with. Because you ever look at some of the artwork when a film gets released overseas or something? It's really incredible what they come up with. I mean, it's like looking at a Wild Eye releasing artwork of one of the covers. You know, they got submarines and airplanes. And none of the stuff is in the movie. So I just find it to be one of those outrageous things. Now, shortly before the film's release, the director, William, he was killed in a helicopter crash in the Philippines while scouting locations for a future film. So, yes, that's how William's life ends, with a helicopter crash. That's very sad. Now, for my thoughts on this one, I mean, look, there's the engaging Tony Curtis, who plays the phony psychic Harry, whose good friend Karen, is played by Susan Strasberg, is suffering through a hell of a problem. The hump on her is growing and growing and growing. And it's not a tumor, is what the doctors first believe. It's actually a god fetus, a reincarnation of this 400-year-old powerful Indian medicine man. Why? Does it really matter? It really doesn't. I mean, the film concept is obviously silly. It's laughable. But it's entertaining. You got to give it that. It is entertaining, right? I mean, we've got the fetus growing and then becoming this shockwave 4-foot Indian medicine man that rips its way out of the tumor, stretches credibility to the umpth degree. Your disbelief is going to have to go so far to understand this. And he's got amazing powers. I mean, he can freeze the entire hospital ward. I mean, at some parts, it's almost like watching, you know, Kolchak, the Night Stalker series from the 70s. I mean, it's seriously messed up. You know, he can bring forth the devil. He can skin people's bodies with just thinking with his mind. I mean, there's some seriously ridiculous things going on here. Very few explanations. And the execution is a bit, whoa, you know, maybe if you got high or drunk, it would maybe make a little bit more sense for this movie. I'm not saying you should do that by any means. But if you're really looking to get to the outer limits of your brain power, this film could really challenge it on a lot of levels. It is a very, very strange movie. In fact, many people quote it as being an insane horror flick. I'm not too far away from that. I really think this movie seriously challenges everything in your mindset out there. So you should definitely be aware of that. Yeah, it's pretty far out there, to say the least. So, and of course, the effects watching them nowadays, they're heavily dated. They really don't look that good. Now, this film I watched on the DVD, and with that being said, right. So I actually realized that I forgot to tell you what band and the song that was playing there. Not too smart, right? So actually, it was two tracks. So we started off actually with White Skull, and the track was Metal Indian, and they're found on Facebook, whiteskull.band. What else? Instagram, and of course, their label was listed as Dragon Heart Records, found on Facebook. Then it was Bloody Hammers with Twilight Zone, which the band is found on Instagram, Bandcamp, and Facebook. Now, let me bring this all up to here. So we hit now Saturday, June 24th, and the film, well, Twilight Zone, the movie from 1983, rated PG, 1 hour and 41 minutes long, celebrating a 40-year anniversary. This is falls into the category of horror and sci-fi. Now, obviously, this is an anthology film with a lot of controversy surrounding the movie. So let's try to dive into this, and we'll work our way through everything. So the directors were Joe Dante, John Landis, George Miller, and Steven Spielberg. The writers were John Landis, George Clayton Johnson, Richard Matheson, Josh Rogan, Jerome Bixby, Robert Garland, and Rod Serling. Now, as for who was actually in the film, there's too many people to really name. I'm just going to touch on a couple of the highlights in here because I really couldn't go all that way with it. It's just too many people. You got Dan Aykroyd, Bill Quinn, Dick Miller, Larry Cedar, Sherry Curry, Kevin McCarthy, Scatman Crothers, Alba Brooks, Selma Diamond. Some of you may remember her name from Night Court, the original series. Vic Morrow, Doug McGrath, Norbert Wessler, Patricia Berry, who else? Jeremy Litch, Evan Richards, Stephen Williams, John Larroquette, Catherine Quinlan, and John Lithgow. Just to name a few, right? I mean, again, I could just go on and on and on in names. It would be amazing. The company that released the film was Warner Brothers. The summary, four horror and sci-fi segments directed by four famous directors, each of them bringing a new version of the classic story from Rod Serling's landmark television series. This has got a 6.4 out of 10. I'd probably give it a 6.5 with an old asterisk there because of one of the stories. The release date for this was June 24th, 1983. Now, as for our taglines, we have two of them. Neither one is good. I have to be honest about that. Neither one is good. And you can pretty much, when I read them, tell why they aren't good. First one. On June 24th, four acclaimed directors, George Miller, John Landis, Joe Dante, and Steven Spielberg, take you to another dimension. Okay. Interesting. And then the second one. You're traveling through another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind, a journey into the wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Next stop, the Twilight Zone. I get it. You're trying to play right through the Twilight Zone itself, its main theme, all that. I get that. But most people seeing this movie know what the Twilight Zone is. It's not that far removed. So the second one doesn't really work at all. It's far too long. No one's standing there reading that long because we don't need to. We know what the Twilight Zone is. We're familiar with it. As for the other one, you don't need to tell us the director's names. They're already on the movie poster itself. So telling us the four directors is redundancy. You could just say something like this. June 24th, a new dimension. That's it, right? You told us the day, so we got it now. June 24th, a new dimension opens, right? So there you go. Or unlocks, or something like that. But you don't need anything else. You got us the date. We know the Twilight Zone is opening itself again. We know that the new dimension is here. We know that it's going to be unlocked or open or whatever it is. You could even have another post that would say, on June 24th, are you willing to step into a new dimension? Kind of inviting you to want to enter that doorway into this new dimension. Would you do it? So I think what I just came up with right now, again, I just spot fire them off to you in approximately 5 to 10 seconds, I think beat the two that you were read. That's, again, what I do. I can quickly can come up with your taglines, and it's how I'm quite honest, it's how I get paid. People come to me for taglines because they know the Baron can deliver them 5 taglines and make sure they're just going to sound right. Well, anyway, the film was worked on a $10 million budget. While the film did gross $29.4 million, it's what happened on the film that blew away the gross and caused a lot of chaos. So let's kind of get into this, because this has got a lot of sadness really wrapped up into it. Here we go. Vic Morrow, all right, had allegedly replied that he's always had a premonition that he was going to die in a helicopter crash. It was what haunted him the most. Now, Vic Morrow was waiting to film what would turn out to be the scene that killed him. And again, he stated this. I said, I must be out of my mind to be doing this. I should have asked for a stunt double. But what can you do? Kill me, right? I mean, so he was joking that, what's the worst that can happen? I get killed? Or maybe I should have asked for the stunt double. And I know that people out there always go with, I'm going to do my own stunts because it sounds courageous. It sounds, you know, I'm tough enough to do my own thing. To a point, okay? I mean, you got to understand something. The stunt people, they know all the things they got to do to pull the stunt off. You could be told, taught, and trained. But hey, do you really want to jump out of the helicopter and fall 40 feet onto an airbag and have to hit a dead center? I don't know about you, but I'm not ever going to do that. That's never going to happen. I'm never going to be going with, gee, there must be a really good reason why I'm doing this. It's not something that it happens. I mean, it's just something in life that I would never have done. And there's so many people out there that go, oh, do that, you know. And I hear the actors all the time about this on sets I've gone to. And I just look at them like, what are you, nuts? There's a stunt person there willing to do the scene already. No offense, you let them do it. They're trained for it. Now, the big thing that ends Vic Morrow's career. The scene of being shot at the time of Vic's fatal accident was added to the script in an attempt to soften his bigoted character, Bill Connor, and to give him some sort of redemption, if you would. While fleeing from American attacks in Vietnam Village, he sees two orphan children. Bill decides to save them no matter what the cost, so he carries them under his arms and wades through the river to safety, and then finds himself back in a Nazi-occupied France again. The two children have time jumped with him. The Nazis take away the children for execution, and Bill takes a train ride. Due to the helicopter accident that claimed his life, the child actors also, who died, all scenes featuring the children were completely cut, and they do not appear in the final film. And Bill's original scripted ending was kept in, leaving Bill's character change largely unaddressed. So there was a lot of problems. But wait, we're not done. Now, this film ended the friendship that he had with John Landis due to the on-set helicopter crash that claimed the lives of Vic and the child actors. Yes, I can see how something like this would shatter a friendship. So, I'm going to try my best with these names. I could put them into the translator. I did that, and they still didn't sound right. So, my apologies in advance for probably butchering these names, but I'm going to try my best. Renee Chen and Mai Ken D. Lee. I tried. Were paid under the table to circumvent the California's child labor laws, which did not permit children to work at night. John Landis admitted to this, opting not to seek a special waiver because he did not think that he would get permission for such the late hour. He denied it was because he thought that he would never get approval to have the children as part of a scene with a low hovering helicopter and a large number of explosives. The scene went horribly wrong, with the helicopter crashing on Vic Morrow and the two children, killing them all instantly. The investigation that followed, with the assistant directors, claimed that they felt uncomfortable with the situation. But Landis saw no harm, so there would be no point in trying to convince him to film the scene without the children, in basically using dummies, or even little persons that would probably have looked more fake. The casting agents also were unaware that children were going to be involved in such a dangerous scene. The associate producer, George Fulsley Jr., had told the children's parents not to tell any firefighters on set that the children were part of the scene, and hid them from the fire safety officer, who also worked as a welfare worker. A fire safety officer was concerned that the blast would cause a crash and shared his concerns with the superior, who told him to take it to the filmmakers. The safety officer did not tell Landis of his concerns, claiming that it's not the way the chain of command works in the fire department. So what we have here are a lot of different people all playing the heads of their departments, but no one actually talking to each other. Now, why does this happen? Okay, so the main reason why this is happening is, first, the director is always the boss on the set. And the people who are in control are being lied to and manipulated. Also, this does not state it, but Landis wanted a bigger pow for the scene. And he wanted more explosives. Now, this was not really notified to the helicopter pilot either. But here's a little factor of life. You have a low hovering object, a helicopter. Now, you pack more explosive under it. What do you think is going to happen? I want you to think about this for just a moment. What do you think is going to happen? It's pretty easy. The more you pump under something, the more the displacement of air. Two things cannot occupy the same space at the exact same time. It's impossible. All right? So, if you have explosives packed and you got more than you need and you hit the button to blow it up, as it's expanding rapidly upward, it's affecting the helicopter above it, thereby changing the air displacement and causing the helicopter to bank incorrectly. The pilot, not knowing that there is more explosive than previously thought, is not going to be able to control the helicopter at such a low altitude, making the entire situation an unpredictable mess. It's just that simple. So, a lawsuit occurred. They went to court, and John Landis was not found guilty of reckless homicide or anything like that. I know there was a settlement probably, okay? The parents, I believe, were on set at the time. Could you imagine the absolute insanity that occurred after the situation had happened? I mean, I don't even know how to explain it. John Larroquette wanted to be on set to see this big explosion, but due to a few transportation problems, he was unable to make it, which maybe was good because he was hoping to get a real close-up kind of scene. And you know, all this chaos happens, and then it's a matter of covering up and, you know, people kind of just hiding and not telling anybody certain things are happening. And it's a traumatic situation. So I've always talked about on the Baron Scripps Show, which is, by the way, coming back next week, so be aware of that, that safety is one of my absolute highest regarded elements that I always want. Just like Lloyd Kaufman on every one of his films, safety, safety, safety. Okay? That is the entire key. I mean, it's just the element. You want to know every aspect. If you're doing a barn burning thing and you're on an independent set, you want to know if all hell breaks loose and the fire doesn't go off right or whatever the hell the damn thing is, that you have a way out of that situation. Because here's the thing, you might have to save your own ass because the situation may spiral out of control and you might have to dive out a window. You're going to want to know what is below you before you have to dive. A situation like this, again, everything predicates on safety. So if you're on a set or you're just even you're wherever you may be and someone hands you a firearm. Number one rule of firearms. If I hand you the weapon and I tell you it is unloaded, if your mother hands you the weapon and tells you it's unloaded, if Jesus Christ was to show up and say the weapon is unloaded, the weapon's loaded. Until you check it yourself, it's loaded. Just like packing a chute for a jumping out of an airplane. Most of us probably don't know how to pack a chute, okay? You must rely on the person packing the chute. Be smart. Take an extra chute. The odds of two being packed incorrectly are rare. But again, these are things you need to do. You have to understand things. Stunt persons who drive cars for the stunts, what do? They make sure they got a walkie-talkie. They make sure they've gone over it and over it and over it. They have practiced hundreds of times. They are familiar with the car they're going to drive. If suddenly someone says to you on a set, oh, we're not going to use that car, we're going to use this car, a car you haven't practiced with, guess what you do? You don't do the stunt because you haven't trained on that vehicle. I've learned this one from talking to people who have done the stunts on these things, and they've all said the exact same thing. You must practice again and again and again and again and again. It's just what you do. You have to practice. You have to become one with the vehicle. You have to become one with whatever is going on. So I don't mean to go off on a side tangent here, but this being the last film of the week, I figured this was a good one to really go out on a well thing. And you really want to make sure you do it right. Because if you don't, you may not get to see the next hour of your life. It could just all end very quickly. So I didn't mean to go off there, but it is a tragic situation that could have been avoided on so many degrees. Was it necessary to put more explosive? No. Did you have to do it? No. Why'd you do it? I wanted to make a bigger bang. Really? That was your answer. I wanted a bigger bang. People have done bigger bangs at concerts in clubs that weren't certified to have fire stunts done to them. But they do it anyway. Why? I want the bigger bang. Screw your bigger bang. All right, so this film references A Bucket of Blood that came out in 1959. It was referenced in Gremlins in 84, Video Violence in 87, Urban Legends, The Final Cut in 2000, The X-Files, the episode Scary Monsters from 2002, Rapid Love, from 2013, and from 2013, and Beyond the Gates from 2016. It, of course, follows the Twilight Zone series, 1959 to 1964, which by this point of 1980 was already in a lot of reruns. Then you had the Twilight Zone series from 85 to 89. Then Twilight Zone, Rod Serling's Lost Classics, the TV movie from 94. Also, then you have the Twilight Zone, the TV series from 2002 to 2003. And Twilight Zone, the TV series from 2019 to 2020. Now, this film is found on DVD, but let's get into my opinion. Obviously, there are four stories. The best way for me to go over these is just to tell you the stories. So in segment one, we have Time Out, where a bigot who hates a certain group of people, actually he hates everybody who isn't his way, will live one day in World War II and be hunted down later by the KKK and get attacked in Vietnam and feel the effects of his hatred. By segment two, we have Kick the Can, which is a nursing home, and the elder inhabitants learn that their minds can keep them young. In segment three, It's a Good Life, a traveler hits a boy in a bicycle with her car and takes the boy home. Soon she learns that the powerful boy brought to her home is indeed something much more. Segment four is Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. The writer is scared to fly, and soon he sees a monstrous creature destroying the airplane engines during a stormy night. This one has been done a few more times than others and has always gotten an audience really great about it. So it is a very good one out there. Overall, I enjoy the film a lot. I like anthology films. I think a lot of you know that. And I really do like the film itself. I think there's a lot of interesting character development in the short stories. It doesn't overstay itself, and it doesn't, how should I put it? It really does give some wonderful creativity at different moments. I really do think it does sell itself well. It's just sad about the backstory. All that, Vic Morrow, everything about that is just, I think, what makes the film so hard to watch, because what you're watching is, especially that Vietnam scene, okay, that's occurring there, you're actually witnessing someone is about to die. And I mean, that's how hard it is to watch that segment, because that's what's happening. You, soon as you see it, you know this is someone who's about to die. And I think that's the hardest part. It's not that they died after making the film and they had a heart attack, a brain aneurysm, they died in a freak thing. No, they died because of someone's sheer audacity for incompetence. And they got to go on and make more movies when they shouldn't. We have seen many times since then directors doing things and getting somebody killed on set, and they're barred. You can never make a movie again. You're not allowed. But he was allowed. I mean, so it's not a 100% when this happens, A will happen. Or when this happens, B is going to happen. Nope, it's all misdirected constantly. Needless to say, that's probably the hardest part of the film, like I said. I mean, you're witnessing a scene that you know, in retrospect, someone is going to die. It makes it very hard to watch the entire movie. But if you can get yourself past that, it's a pretty good film to watch, and I would recommend it. With that being said, I'm going to play two tracks here on the way out. First one is from a band called Blind Head, and the track is Purple Haze, a cover track. This is reference to Purple Haze was actually used in this film, so here's a cover track for that. You can find the band on Instagram and Bandcamp. Then we have Bloody Hammers with our closeout customary track, Welcome to the Horror Show. Again, they are found on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And, of course, we have a video of that track on our Horror Times. So, again, I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to me, Baron Craze, talk about the films I saw on this particular week. I would like you to also take some time to like the Horror Times Facebook page. We're so close to 5,000 followers or likes or however that thing works. I've been told it 12 times. I still don't know exactly what I'm supposed to say, but you guys pretty much can figure it out. Please take some time to like The Baron's Crip on Facebook. Also, if you can, follow the bands. Support the artists. Because without you, these artists, some of them will just fade away and be forgotten if it's not for somebody like me playing their music still. So definitely take the time to like the bands. Don't steal the music. Actually buy the music. It would be greatly appreciated to the bands. I definitely support that that aspect. So with that being said, hey, enjoy your pleasant nightmares out there and tantalize your eyeballs with some good horror movies and not complete wretched messes out there. Enjoy.
Shame are so far out of range. The blame is left on